Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Granite State businesses have long bemoaned New Hampshire's high energy costs, complaining they discourage expansion here and even tempt some firms to leave the state. And so last fall, the Business and Industry Association launched a new campaign called Energize New Hampshire to focus attention on what it calls a crisis, the high price of energy, and the need for more infrastructure and supply to lower those costs. The Energize NH campaign comes as the Granite State is engaged in a huge discussion about energy over pipelines and power lines, and whether other approaches are also in order, including better efficiency, a smarter grid, and an emphasis on those power sources that don't contribute to climate change. Today in The Exchange, what it might take to energize New Hampshire. We'll look at this campaign and the issues and questions it raises. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests with us. Jim Roach is here, president of the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire. And Jim, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Clay Mitchell, founding member and advisor of the New Hampshire Clean Tech Council. Clay is also a lecturer in the Department of Natural Resources and the Environment at UNH. And Clay, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Thank you, Laura.
We also have two reporters with us who've been covering these energy issues. Dave Solomon, reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. He writes the regular energy column called Power Plays. Dave, thanks for your time.
Glad to be here.
Also with us, Sam Evans-Brown, our own environment reporter here at NHPR. And Sam, thanks for helping us out.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Jim, I want to start with you since this is your campaign. The BIA says Energize NH is about focusing attention on New Hampshire's electrical energy crisis. What does that crisis look like, Jim?
Well, it manifests itself in the form of very high electrical energy costs for businesses and residents alike. Our electrical energy costs in New Hampshire are consistently 50% higher than the national average. New England and New Hampshire have the highest electrical energy rates in the contiguous U.S., and the consequence of continued high electrical energy costs is that many employers, particularly those that are heavy energy users, are looking at their options. Many of them already have options outside of New Hampshire and around the globe, and they're in some cases exercising those options. Even before we launched our Energize New Hampshire campaign, we saw a couple of well-known companies expand operations outside of New Hampshire that could have taken place here. Sturm Ruger, for example, expanded into North Carolina. Foss Manufacturing expanded into Georgia. And there are other calculations going on like that all the time. And so the long-term consequences of not bringing down exceptionally high electrical energy costs really present New Hampshire with some serious economic challenges.
So let us in on some of those discussions, Jim, those companies that you mentioned or maybe others where they sit down, things are going well, it's time to expand, and they have a choice to make.
Right. So virtually every sophisticated employer that is looking to grow will put together, a matrix, and it will include things like tax rates and access to a well-qualified workforce and proximity to markets. But for big energy users, it includes the cost of electricity and other forms of energy. And increasingly, New Hampshire and New England are uncompetitive in that regard. And so, as I indicated just a moment ago, a couple of companies have been in the news, and more companies are looking at those factors. I would say the top two considerations for large energy users about where to grow are the availability of STEM-educated and workplace-ready young people to replace their aging workforce, and the high cost of electrical energy. And I would note that in New Hampshire, manufacturing drives the economy. All sectors of the economy are important. Tourism is very important. Healthcare is very important. Financial services, business services are all very important. But what drives the economy in virtually every economic measure in New Hampshire is manufacturing. And unfortunately, manufacturing is one of the sectors of the economy that's most sensitive to the high cost of electricity. And as I said, many New Hampshire operations are branch operations. Many operations in New Hampshire manufacturers that are headquartered here have other facilities already. And the danger going forward, the critical concern going forward is that these companies are looking very seriously at options outside of New Hampshire for their growth. And because it's such an important piece of the economy, that does not portend well for New Hampshire's long-term economic viability.
And I'm struck by that 50% number that you gave us, Jim, in terms of energy costs here in New Hampshire and New England versus elsewhere. And I think the question we're going to focus on this hour is, you know, why our costs are so much higher and what do we do about it? So let's bring in our other guests. And Sam Evans Brown, to you, how much agreement is there in the state as a whole now that our energy costs do indeed constitute a crisis or at least a major concern?
Well, I'd say that if you were to look historically at energy costs in New England, it's absolutely true that they are some of the highest in the country. You mentioned the contiguous U.S. There are, of course, you know, Alaska and Hawaii do have higher than here, but they're special cases. But that's not really new. In fact, if you look back, you know, 2007, 2008, before the market crash, we were spending, you know, $12 to $14 billion a year in the regional energy markets, and if you know, as recently as 2012. That was down around $6 billion, so actually lower than in the past. What is new is that we have been having from the winters of 2013 till now, we've been having these wintertime spikes in prices where actually, well, if you take the winter out and look at the trend and the cost of electricity and natural gas, they've been trending down. But then you have these massive spikes during the winter months where costs go up as much as four or five times. And that then, you know,
that skews the whole picture.
Skews the whole average. Exactly. And of course, businesses, because of the way their electricity, they pay for electricity in a way that's different from us. They are more exposed to those spikes than the rest of us, which then leads to campaigns like the BIA's Energize New Hampshire.
Oh, so that's interesting. So how is a manufacturer paying his or her electric bill different from me paying it, Sam, besides the scale?
They tend to be buying from competitive suppliers. So they're not just buying electricity from Eversource or Unitil or whoever the utility is. They're going out onto the market and signing contracts directly with brokers who are working directly with power plants. And a lot of times, you know, it varies a great deal from contract to contract, but a lot of times those contracts do vary month by month. They might follow the market. Whereas you and I typically are paying a 6-month rate that is adjusted, you know, at sort of very slowly as kind of an average of the market.
I love your take, Dave, on why energy prices, especially for businesses, as Sam describes, are so high here in New Hampshire and New England.
Well, as Sam explained, energy prices have been historically high in New England because we're sort of at the end of the pipeline for fuel sources in terms of natural gas, which fuels most of the power in the region and has, at least for the past 7 to 8 years.
That's a big shift, though, right, Dave? I mean, we used to have a more mixed source of electrical energy supply. And just
right.
In the last
so the,
5, 6,
the,
7
the
years,
the winter spikes weren't a factor until we became so reliant on natural gas, because it's in the winter that the pipeline is all booked up with natural gas on the way for home heating. If you look at the pipeline as kind of like a big jumbo jet, the utilities that have to provide fuel for home heating buy their seats on a reserve basis, and they pay a higher price when you buy a reserve seat. The power plant owners and, to a large extent, the business and industry buyers say, we'll go on standby and get a really low price. And, most of the days of the year, there's plenty of standby seats available at a very low price. But in the winter, when so many of those seats are booked for home heating, there is the few seats left are very pricey, and the price goes through the ceiling, which is contributing to these spikes that Sam alluded to. But there is also a factor contributing to high electricity costs in New England that doesn't get a lot of attention given the focus on energy supply, and that's the cost of transmitting and distributing the energy, which is extremely high in New England compared to the rest of the country as well. for reasons that are not as simply explained as matters of fuel supply. And Jim's clients and the Business and Industry Association have to pay the same distribution and transmission costs that we all do. And in New England, they make up a much larger portion of the bill. I brought my electric bill here. It's $150. Only $80 of that is for the energy supply.
The rest is paying for the grid.
$70 of it was for the transmission lines and the distribution poles. That's almost half the bill. In other parts of the country, it's a quarter of the bill or less.
So. Okay, I have to ask, why is that? I know you guys want to jump in, but go ahead. What's wrong with our transmission system, Dave?
Well, there have been a lot of very costly upgrades in recent years that have been built into our transmission and distribution rates. Many of these projects that have been approved at a certain price have come in at much higher prices. And as long as the utility company can prove that these additional investments were necessary and prudent, the regulators sign off on them, and those costs are reflected in our bills every month.
Wow. Okay. Jim, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead real quick, and then I want to bring Clay Mitchell in.
Just to put the – notwithstanding Dave's comments about the distribution and transmission piece of the bill, and it is an issue, and I think the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is looking into that. But just with regard to the energy side of the equation, I mentioned our – costs over the last several years have been very high. Our own Public Utilities Commission has a bar graph, and they use the winter of 2011-12 as sort of a benchmark winter when the weather was typical for New England and the supply roughly met demand. And then they did a comparison of the cost of electrical energy for the succeeding winters. And if you total up all the excess costs then over what we would have paid in a normal winter, like 11-12 when supply met demand, that's an $8.9 billion premium the region has paid. New Hampshire is roughly 10% of that. So New Hampshire alone over those three winters, the previous three winters, not this winter, paid a premium of almost $900 million in extra electrical energy costs. That's a huge total. If legislators are looking at a tax increase in New Hampshire of almost $1 billion, you can bet a lot of folks would be concerned about that. So this is many people consider it, and it really is a bit of a backdoor premium or tax that businesses, commercial industrial customers, and homeowners are paying here in New Hampshire. So it's a very significant concern. And even, if I may, this winter that is just ending, where rates were more moderate because we had the warmest winter on record, our wholesale electricity prices were still 19% higher than that benchmark winter of 11-12. And if you do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, that's $30 million more this winter that we paid here in New Hampshire for electrical energy than that benchmark winter.
Even though there wasn't that competition between heating natural gas and electric energy
and
natural gas.
We still paid more. And few people think that we're going to continue to see warm winter. We will no doubt can have warm winters from time to time. But, I mean, if you think that the warmest winter on record will continue every year, then perhaps we won't have a problem. But most thoughtful people don't think that will happen.
Well, and the elephant in the room here, based on everything you guys said, is has New England put too many of its eggs in the natural gas basket? And we'll talk about that in just a second. But Clay Mitchell, let's go to you. So we're hearing complaints about high prices and the impact on our economy. Why do you think energy prices, electricity prices are so high here in New Hampshire?
I think we've been a little bit delayed in trying to come up with solutions to address it. I don't think we forecasted well enough to understand that, you know, there was a certain amount of capacity in the gas pipelines, and then all of a sudden we have all gas generation. I mean, that's a pretty simple spreadsheet.
50%, and that's a lot just in the past couple of years.
Right, and we have been dilatory in responding with things like energy efficiency and other programs that are much cheaper than the cost of generation. I mean, I take, for instance, Don Kreese's recent Concord Monitor op-ed where he talked about the need for us to really start focusing on energy efficiency, which is dramatically cheaper than the price of energy in other parts of the country. And I respect the use of the term crisis to get people motivated about issues, but I really think we need to take a more holistic look at what we need to do, what sources of the solution there are, working with individual companies, particularly some of these manufacturers that have these complaints, and trying to find out what kind of solutions we can provide them rather than putting more gas pipelines and more gas plants on the ground and try and figure out what is the best way to provide the solution that they need.
So, Clay, in your opinion, it's not a supply problem, it's an efficiency problem?
I
I think you should look at efficiency as a supply. It's a kind of supply. You know, the power you don't have to buy is much cheaper than the power you do buy. And if there are ways that we can work with people to implement efficiency and a more modern grid that can respond in different ways, we will be able to meet some of these concerns without just straight supply of more electrons.
Let me invite our listeners to join us, and then I know you all have a lot more to say. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're taking another look at electricity prices in New Hampshire and New England, why they're so high, and a new campaign from the Business and Industry Association to tackle that problem called Energize NH. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments on this, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So since you mentioned efficiency, Clay, here's an email from Gary who says, I have spoken with many engineers who feel we waste as much as 30% of the energy we produce. Gary says, I work at DHMC in Lebanon and see it firsthand, lights on during the day, in windowed hallways, the cafeteria with all that natural daylight and the lights on, the huge solarium with the lights on during the day, et cetera, et cetera. Is this statement true? Could your panel speak to the low-hanging fruit of energy efficiency and waste? Go ahead, Sam Evans-Brown, you first.
So the most recent study that was done about this for New Hampshire was back in, I think, 2014. And what it found is that New Hampshire could be doing 10 times as much energy efficiency investment as it currently is doing, and that could still be cost effective. And if you look at what Clay was alluding to when we talk about buying energy efficiency instead of supply, if electricity load grows, you need to build more power plants. And what does that cost? Versus if we are able to shrink electricity load and don't have to build those power plants, what does that cost? What that study found is that by buying energy efficiency, quote unquote, you're spending something like half as much as what it would cost to build new power plants. The trick is, how do you pay for that? And that's the big question.
And who?
Right, exactly. Historically, that's been paid for by a systems benefits charge, which is just another line on that transmission and distribution half of the bill that Dave's got over there. And historically, businesses have not liked that charge because it increases their electric rates. And we can talk about how efficiency saves money as a policy, but if you as a business are not having any of those measures installed in your building, but you're still paying for that line item, that's just another increase in cost for you. And so historically, businesses have pushed back against that systems benefits charge.
Well, Jim, how do you feel about the critique that the issue is not about supply, but about a lack of fortitude when it comes to efficiency?
I think it's sort of an all of the above response. Certainly, efficiency is an important component in getting a handle on electrical energy costs. You know, renewables are an important component. But I would just simply say that large energy users, almost to a company, have invested heavily in their own efficiency, whether or not they've been able to access the system, these incentives that the utilities provide and that we all pay for. It's in their best interest to tighten up their building envelope and to invest in more efficient operations, including machinery.
So they're already doing it.
Absolutely, they're doing it because they're competing in the national and global marketplace. So if they can drive down their costs by lowering electrical energy costs, they are doing that. They have done. They've invested hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars in making that happen. I can't speak for the residential sector or other parts of the economy, but I can tell you absolutely large energy users are doing everything they can to lower their electrical energy bills through the use of efficiency measures.
So, Clay, when we talk about efficiency and we could save, you know, a gazillion dollars or not build 10 new power plants or whatever through better efficiency, I mean, what do we mean? Do we mean, you know, a business putting in better windows, something as small as that? Do we mean a smarter grid? I mean, what does that really mean?
It pretty much means everything. And, it's hard to deconstruct this into individual facilities. But, you know, facilities, a lot of facilities don't have a heavy thermal load for keeping their buildings at a certain temperature. But if they do, then tightening the building envelope will help. Demand response, which is, you know, managing the timing and the amount of energy that comes into a facility at a particular time, is one opportunity. There are companies out there that specialize in that. There's a company called Enernoc, which works with individual companies to try and control their demand charges by spreading out the use of energy, turning lights off during the day and things like that. I think that getting back to that email, it could potentially be correct that there are a lot of places that still haven't maximized their efficiency opportunities, and being able to do that, I think, is an opportunity that we're missing.
A lot more to talk about in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the Energy Outlook for New Hampshire. We're looking at a new campaign from the Business and Industry Association called Energize NH, focused on energy issues, including especially cost and supply. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests with us. Jim Roach is here, president of the New Hampshire Business and Industry Association. Also, Clay Mitchell, founding member and advisor of the New Hampshire Clean Tech Council. Sam Evans-Brown, environment reporter for NHPR. And Dave Solomon, reporter for the Union Leader in New Hampshire Sunday News. Dave's energy column is called Power Plays. And Dave, I did want to turn to you also on this efficiency conversation that we've been having. If I'm a business, you know, I say, hey, look at this new power plant. It's going to bring X megawatts onto the grid. I like that. That'll help me out. Energy efficiency, how do you measure how many megawatts I'm going to benefit from as a business? What guarantee is there that these big savings that people talk about will materialize?
Well, they're long-term savings, and I think the businesses are looking for more immediate relief. There's pretty broad consensus that efficiency is an important part of the mix, and it's been happening. Electricity consumption is actually declining nationally and in New England, in large part because of more efficient appliances, more solar, more sealed buildings, and all of the things we've been doing for the past 20 years. But it will not translate into the kind of relief on pricing that these businesses are seeking in the short term. It has reduced consumption, which overall will reduce prices because the less you consume, the fewer power plants have to be built, the fewer investments have to be made that affect cost. But that is a long-term proposition.
And harder to measure.
And harder to measure in terms of immediate savings.
Go ahead, Sam.
I just wanted to clarify really quickly what we're talking about when we're talking about energy efficiency. There are incentive programs that any homeowner or business can access that'll pay for roughly half of your cost to do things like insulate your home. But mostly we're talking about thermal efficiency. Insulation, you know, tightening the envelope, which is saying sealing the cracks basically so air doesn't seep in.
Not leaking heat or cooling out.
And unless your home is heated with electricity, we're not really talking about saving electric costs. But there is a nexus between thermal, you know, heating costs and electric costs. And that's because in many places, people are burning natural gas to heat their homes. So if you have to burn less of it, it eases space on that pipeline, deals with those winter peaking problems that we've been talking about.
Right. I love your thoughts too, Clay, and you, Jim, on this idea that, you know, Sam said, and I've heard others say, yes, energy efficiency means we wouldn't have to build, you know, X number of new power plants, and that's a savings. But it's a little bit harder to wrap your hands around, Clay, than we're going to build this new wind farm and it's going to generate X megawatts. So if you're a business, you want that certainty that more power is coming onto the grid right now.
I don't know. I think that enough work has been done in the efficiency field to be able to measure and verify the types of infrastructure that's being installed. One of the best users is the federal government, and they have an entire kind of stealth agency called FEMP, which is the Federal Energy Management Program, I believe. And that the sole purpose of that entity is to go around and deal with federal buildings and do efficiency related to water, thermal, and electric use. And there is no larger building space owner than the United States federal government. And so they've been doing this for decades. They have measurement and verification techniques that are spot on. They know what it means to install a variable frequency drive over a traditional drive. And it's very easy to do this kind of stuff. And this is direct work, hands-on for the business that will see savings immediately. And this gets at that multiplier effect. If you bring the savings to them immediately, they have more money to invest. They're more comfortable about the long-term future. And I think that we have to be very careful about trying to find short-term solutions that are not in our best long-term interest. And, you know, when you give somebody efficiency, you've solved a problem for a very long time, at least until the next technology comes out that's even more efficient. And so I think it's important to maintain that long-term focus while we still try and address the short-term issue that people are concerned about. And I think at some point, and I hate to lob this hand grenade in here, we need to talk about the efficiency of the utilities themselves. themselves and how they are structured, how we compensate them, how we regulate them, and how we force them into this kind of conundrum where we want them to make money, but then we want them to sell less power. And I want to reserve that topic in the hopes that we'll have a spirited conversation about that.
Well, absolutely. One more basic question about efficiency, Clay. What about the actual grid itself? I mean, how much electricity leaks out once it leaves that power plant?
Those numbers are all over the place. I've seen numbers on the national average of 6 to 7% leaking out. But then you trace that back to the combustion cycle at the plant. You know, some traditional plants are as low as 30. You get combined cycle gas plants that get up to in the 40s. And if you can install things like combined heat and power plants at some of these facilities, now you're talking 80% efficiency, where you can trap and capture the waste heat to use in a process or in the management of the building while generating energy on site. And this gets into that whole concept of disruption. And now you're allowing me to get right back into the utility thing, which I don't want to start.
Well, and before we get to disruption, and we will, Jim, again, this keeps coming up. For example, and talking about lobbing something else into our conversation, the pipeline in the southern tier of New Hampshire. This energy efficiency discussion we're having right now fits perfectly into that. People are strongly opposed to that pipeline in that area, at least a lot of people. And they say, look, if New Hampshire were more efficient, we wouldn't have to dig up the dirt, make a bigger pipeline, and so forth. I wonder what you think.
Well, as I said earlier, efficiency is an important component in the overall energy mix. And I think most of my members have embraced efficiency and will continue to do so. Having said that, we have the highest electrical energy costs right now in the contiguous U.S., and many significant employers in the state are looking at their options, and many of those options include growing outside of New Hampshire. I would note that both at least one commissioner of our own Public Utilities Commission and the New England ISO have both acknowledged the need for more pipeline and transmission capacity, and those folks are the experts. So as important as embracing and investing in efficiency is, as important as embracing and investing in renewable energy is, so too is the need for additional infrastructure in the form of pipeline and transmission. And those are the experts, and those are the folks that are monitoring the system, regulating the system, and they're telling us we need more capacity.
And is the BIA coming out in favor of that Southern New Hampshire pipeline?
We are agnostic on the Kinder Morgan pipeline, just as we are agnostic on the Northern Pass pipeline project. There are two other projects that impact New Hampshire. Spectra has a pipeline expansion project, and Portland Natural Gas has a project that would reverse the flow of natural gas. I guess our opinion is we need to do something, whatever it looks like. We have a very rigorous site evaluation process, and if one or more of those projects make it through that rigorous process and are standing and are permitted, then that's appropriate. And if they don't, that's also appropriate.
Sam, what are others saying about that southern pipeline and whether there's a need for it? There's been a lot of discussion about this.
There has.
From a lot of smart people.
Indeed, been a lot of discussion. I think that it is fair to say that amongst those who are expert in this question, there is a consensus that the natural gas pipeline constraints are very real and are a problem. There is much less consensus as to what the best solution is.
And widening the pipeline, whether that's what we really need to do.
More pipelines. You know, for instance, we haven't touched on this yet, but a lot of groups are concerned about climate change. And is natural gas, a natural gas pipeline that's expected to be in service for 40 years the best decision when climate change is increasingly an issue that people are concerned about? And so for instance, The Massachusetts Attorney General's office came out with a report that said, okay, we're seeing these issues with wintertime electricity reliability, where the ISO New England is saying that, in fact, we might have reliability problems, i.e. blackouts caused by not enough generation or constraints on pipelines or transmission.
Because the pipeline is crowded. All those people who signed up for those reserve seats that Dave Solomon said have already reserved that natural gas for
not
home
there
heating.
There won't be enough natural gas to fuel the power plants.
Leftover for electricity.
Right. Brownouts, blackouts, who knows what. But what is the best thing to do about that is the real question. And the Massachusetts Attorney General's office found, or their study concluded, that the most cost-effective way to deal with this is not to build more natural gas pipelines, but to invest in targeted energy efficiency spending and demand response. And that, again, for those who don't know that term, is to say reshaping demand to fit the supply. So say we don't have enough power plants to turn on, maybe we can pay some people to turn down their usage in those peak moments.
Because we're not talking about all winter long. We're talking about a couple days when it's super cold.
Yeah, and it varies winter by winter, but you know, something on the order of 20 to 30 days in 2014, 2015.
Here's an email from John who says, why is it okay to support currently perceived low-cost fossil fuel infrastructure when over 90% of scientists say the risks of a warming climate pose threats to humans and numerous species, including many our state depends on, from moose to sugar maples to snow? He says a new study confirms fracking releases significant amounts of methane, a potent greenhouse gas. John concludes by saying there will be a price put on greenhouse gases before long. This should not be ignored when considering long-term assets like a pipeline. Clay, what do you think? And then we'll go to our callers.
Great comment. What do you want to add? I mean, this is this tension between an immediate solution and a long-term solution. You know, I think that one of the concerns that we need to be aware of in putting all of our eggs in one basket, as you said earlier, is, you know, what if we find out fracking is a problem and we start regulating it more and we start, pricing in that the impacts from fracking.
Then natural gas prices go way up.
Huge, right. And or if, you know, you follow the discussions about a price on carbon, whether it's revenue neutral, fee and dividend, whatever you want to call it, which is gaining support on both sides of the aisle, you will again have the same effect that fossil fuels will go up. And so I think we have to balance the short-term, you know, reaction with a long-term plan, dare I say. Not that we would ever have a plan in place, but it would be a good time to start talking about that. We do have the 10-year energy strategy in the state. It's time to start looking at it and implementing it and try and lower our costs as well as stabilize them into the future. Because if we do end up with our eggs in the basket and they all go rotten, we're going to be in a world of hurt.
Well, John, thanks for the email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And to Kelly in Piermont first. Hi, Kelly. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Kelly.
I am a generator in Piermont that is helping to reduce some of the leakage by generating right in New Hampshire. And the one way that in New Hampshire smaller consumers can reduce their costs is participating in New Hampshire legislation called group net metering. And this is something that allows the generators who are not using natural gas to put electricity into the grid that can be consumed and actually have their cost recovered rather than simply paying into an inefficient market that requires that the buyers purchase the electricity at the absolute lowest rate, even though it is making a greater contribution. And so the
Kelly, what kind of energy are you generating?
I'm generating energy using water. It's hydroelectric power. In the town of Piermont, I am generating enough power for about 110 New Hampshire homes. Obviously, many businesses can also tap into that, especially the local businesses, because the electrons are going to be delivered to the nearest consumers.
Right. So, Kelly, yeah, thank you for calling in. And, you know, we have done whole hours, right, Sam Evans Brown, on net metering and so forth. But we should talk about this. Dave Solomon, I'll turn to you first. Smaller generators, whether it's solar panels on the town hall roof or small hydro generators like Kelly, are contributing in some way to our supply.
Yeah, that's called distributed generation, meaning it's distributed amongst a large number of small producers instead of the legacy model of a handful of giant power plants. But much like energy efficiency, distributed generation is something we should encourage, that many policymakers think we should have incentives for to develop for the long-term solution. But we have an immediate problem with energy prices in the winter due to the constraints on the pipelines that does need to be addressed in some capacity. And the argument about natural gas being a fossil fuel and contributing to the greenhouse effect is true, but it's not as bad as oil and coal, and we're not building any new nuclear plants. And distributed energy and renewables are not going to be ready to generate the 30,000 megawatts that New England needs next week. So at least natural gas is there to kind of transition us out of coal and oil into the period 10, 20, 30 years down the road when we will be relying more heavily on renewables and distributed energy. So we do need to solve this transmission problem on the interim. It is an infrastructure issue, and the region will have to make some decisions. But Energize NH just says, well, we need something done. My only issue with the organization is it hasn't come out and said what solution it endorses. I mean, the elephant in the room is you're talking about more hydro from Quebec and pipeline expansion in some capacity. Those are the only two real options on the table, the biggies. And, you know, when it comes to hydro from Quebec, there's Northern Pass, but there's also a line that's already approved and licensed in Vermont that can get 1,000 megawatts from Quebec very soon if we so choose. And as regards the pipeline, there is the big Kinder Morgan proposal, but there's also another plan to sort by Eversource and its partners to just expand an existing pipeline, dig it up, make it a little wider, put in a few more connections and so forth that would fuel the gas plants
in a less disruptive way.
So there's a variety of proposals on the table. When it comes to the generation, we could use another 1,000 megawatts from Quebec. Whether that'll have an immediate effect on pricing is not guaranteed. It will certainly help with reliability. And we need more supply, which we know would help with pricing. But do we need to – it's like the main turnpike expansion. Do we need to expand it from three lanes to four just because of a couple busy weeks in the summer? That's the question we're wrestling with.
Okay, I can see everybody wants to jump in. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, just to speak for the BIA, we did look very seriously at whether or not we should be endorsing specific projects. We had a series of conversations at the policy committee level. We have five policy committees run by and populated by our members. We had a very robust discussion at an executive committee meeting, and we settled our position of not taking a position on these projects at a board meeting. And the reason for that is that we engage pretty heavily in public policy advocacy at the state house and with state regulators. And the feeling of my board was if we support a specific project, then we go to the state house and we say, because there's a lot of legislation to thwart, delay, add to the cost of these various projects. And we've fought all of them. We have an existing system in place, approval process through the site evaluation committee in place. And so there's a lot of legislation that would sidetrack those things and add to the cost, delay, or essentially kill these projects. We don't think that's appropriate. So we lobby against that stuff. And the minute we are supporting a specific project is the minute we lose our credibility to be advocating against things that would be at odds with the existing site evaluation process. So that's the reason we haven't supported any specific project. But we've been very clear that we're in a crisis and we need more capacity, pipeline transmission capacity.
Clay, to this point that Dave described, natural gas often described as a bridge fuel to get us from this sort of big legacy, you know, coal, nuclear, to an energy future that may involve small hydro like a collar or solar or wind. Some people call natural gas a bridge fuel. Other people call it a excuse to put off the inevitable fuel, that the availability of natural gas will only postpone those tough decisions. I wonder what you think about the role of natural gas and whether it's a bridge fuel or a get you off the hook for now fuel.
Well, to again use your analogy, how wide is the bridge, right? If it is a bridge fuel that allows us to provide a fast dispatchable, you know, power supply that can balance out the current issues we have with intermittency and renewable power, that makes a lot of sense. If we go too far, we push off that inevitable opportunity. You know, we're looking at a period of incredible disruption, disruption with technology, disruption with business models, and a disruption to, you know, the traditional utility structure. You know, if you're familiar with ARPA-E, which is a government program that kind of supports innovation in the energy field, there are groups out there that are creating technologies that will work within the grid, opening and closing circuit breakers to reduce congestion. And this is happening in other ISOs, and we're, again, behind kind of the ball on some of this stuff. We need a market or an environment that allows us to kind of grab that disruption and move it forward.
I think we need about five more days to talk about this topic as well. We'll be back in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at New Hampshire's energy debate, especially cost and supply issues. We're looking at why New Hampshire has such high electrical costs and a recent campaign from the Business and Industry Association called Energize NH to address those issues. You can join us as well, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. Bill's in Dover. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Laura and guests. I'm the ranking member of the House Science and Technology and Energy Committee, and I really appreciate this show today. A lot of great information. Just a couple quick points. One is the discussion of energy is really difficult unless you think about it and where we ought to be in the future. And are we on the right glide slope to get there? And I want to remind the listeners, I know the panel knows this, but Energy New Hampshire is only about a third of it is electricity. The rest is a third of approximately in heating and about a third in transportation fuels. And another issue is that I just want to raise is that thinking about fossil fuels is a, sort of the cheap, quick fix. And that's the today perspective. There are a lot of risks in that. And one is that current prices have never been a good predictor of future prices. The oil and gas markets are not free markets. Much of the production is controlled by state-owned companies that set production based on internal domestic needs. It's a highly volatile market that has eluded the best experts at actually predicting future availability and prices. And we're growing more dependent on natural gas for the region's electricity generation.
As so would you like to see us turn away from that, Bill? And how so? Because we talked earlier about, yes, the other fuels might be cleaner, and yes, we shouldn't rely too much on natural gas. But businesses are saying, and Dave Solomon described this, they need certainty and they need it now. They need to turn on the lights at the plant tomorrow.
Yep. Well, it is a complicated issue, and those that have been saying all of the above is the correct answer. I just remind people that we're spending about $6 billion a year in New Hampshire on energy. $4 billion of that's leaving the state. So ways that will retain some of the money in the state and reduce the needs are important things to consider. And a diverse renewable energy supply is an important aspect to start getting us on that glide slope to where we need to be. Reducing our dependency on inefficient, dirty fuels is important. We probably need to add some natural gas. And it's probably more, I would argue, for the industry. It may be for the internal consumption rather than from electricity, because the big issue with electricity is, as people have said, is shaving the peaks. And that can be done
Bill,
with a relatively small injection.
I'm glad you called in, and I'm asking you a couple questions because, as you said, you are chair of this energy committee. So one last question for you.
Ranking member.
Ranking
Don't
member,
get me
okay.
Chair.
If I, pardon me, I didn't mean to give you a promotion there on the air. I did want to ask you one last question, and I've heard this from some folks in the business sector, that New Hampshire is getting a reputation as the state of no when it comes to energy. We fight wind power projects. We fight Northern Pass hydropower. We fight expanded pipeline. And in the end, energy companies are just going to say, you know, forget it, New Hampshire. You're on your own. I wonder what you think.
Well, I think to succeed, we're going to need to do this together. And I think that we're trying to do this. We have an onslaught right now of numerous large projects that are going forward, and we've got a lot of things that we need to deal with. And this is something that business, industry, residents, and the legislature need to come together and find some common solutions so that we can be truly competitive and responsible over the long term. We need to be finding plans that get us to those goals that people have been talking about, where we know we need to be in 10 years from now, and do it in a way so the business stays competitive and prices are affordable and the environment is getting cleaner.
Okay. Bill, thank you very much for calling in. And to you first, Sam, and then you, Jim. What about that? The Granite State is the state of no when it comes to energy.
Well, so this is an interesting point, and this is actually, I think, probably the strongest argument in favor of distributed generation, that solar panels on roofs, small local
– that hydropower.
Yeah, exactly, in your neighborhood. And that's that it's much easier to site. So if you need to build a massive plant – you see or a power line to Quebec. You see how much work it takes to get that through, how many years that can be delayed, whereas putting up solar panels is generally much easier as long as you're not covering, acres and acres of farms with them. And to put some numbers to this, a lot of people dismiss distributed generation out of hand and say it's not big enough to make a real impact. The ISO New England has predicted that by early 2020s, we'd see something like 2,400 megawatts of solar on the grid. And true, that's only generating when the sun is shining, but when the sun is shining tends to be the time that demand is greatest. So it's selling into the peak, as they say, which does a lot to reduce prices. So it's not inconsequential.
So don't dismiss the importance of these smaller projects sprinkled all over New England.
Right. I mean, if we look, there's 4,200 megawatts of plants retiring and 2,400 megawatts of solar coming online. I mean, that's a big chunk.
Yeah. Clay, go ahead, and then Jim.
Well, I think one of the issues, and Sam hit it right on the head, is, you know, and people are saying that it's not enough. The reason it's not enough is because our policies are antiquated. You know, we don't have a policy or a plan in place to really capture the energy, so to speak, behind the distributed energy market. And there's a lot of innovations out there. Storage is coming. It's being employed elsewhere.
Storing
that energy and using it at an appropriate time. Having the utility control those storage devices so that they can tap into them when the power peaks at particular times. These are all things that are possible and happening in other grids, but not in our grid. We're just behind the time, and our regulations are what is placing the cap on our ability to put the distributed generation on the ground that really matters.
When you say regulation, you mean net metering?
Yeah, well, net metering is one of the examples. I mean, and you know, we need to move beyond net metering because that argument is done. It's time to get to the value of solar and real data from the utility so we know what the value of solar is and bring them into the discussion and get somewhere that it matters.
And Jim, I can see you want to jump in. Quick clarification from you, Clay. When you say we, do you mean New England or New Hampshire?
Well, I think New Hampshire. I think New Hampshire is a little bit more behind than the other states in New England in this issue particularly.
I was in Vermont last year and was struck by the number of solar panels I saw, not just on people's houses, but you know, big fields and so forth. Go ahead, Jim. Love your thoughts here, too.
Well, first of all, you mentioned the state of no. There's a new acronym that I heard out there. We're familiar with NIMBY and BANANA, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone. The latest acronym I heard was NOPE, not on planet Earth. So the opponents to the various infrastructure projects are very well organized. It's noteworthy that over 30% of existing generation is about to retire from the regional grid or is at risk, 30% of the existing capacity within the region. And so the legislator that called made some outstanding points and talked about, legislators and the business community and residential customers coming together. I would argue that in many regards, we have come together. The site evaluation process was updated last session to include more public representation, to include more public hearings. We can't ignore the state is at risk of continued high electrical energy costs and the consequences of that. And the consequences are the most important sector of our economy, manufacturing, by virtue of the number of jobs, the compensation of the jobs, the contribution to gross state product, exports, new dollars, new wealth coming into the economy and circulating throughout the economy. If we don't address this problem soon, we will pay the price for decades to come as these employers, these leading employers throughout the state, exercise options outside of New Hampshire and, God forbid, take existing jobs and relocate them out of New Hampshire.
And, Jim, what do you think about the point that Clay has made a couple times, that New Hampshire is sort of stuck in old thinking, you know, more big legacy utility scale projects, that it's time for new thinking around this?
I think there is new thinking going on, and I think we're in a transition period, and we need some of these infrastructure projects to take hold to transition us to this new energy economy. We're not there yet. And we're not going to be there in the next 5, 10, 15 years. We're getting there, but we need action now.
Do you want to jump in?
There is a big obstacle toward getting toward the energy future that has been so effectively articulated here, and that is the utility incentive, the incentive of a very powerful and well-funded player in this whole scheme is geared toward not enlisting their cooperation in this transition, but in having them actually execute measures that delay and preserve the legacy system, which they know how to operate and which has proven remarkably profitable for them.
So disruption that, is not,
not
in
a
their
knock
interest.
On them, right? That's not a knock on them as people or their interest in mankind. It is where their profit motive is structured, and businesses will go where their profit motive takes them. And our current laws regarding utilities rewards them most for building things and building them as most expensively as possible because they are guaranteed 10% return on everything they build.
So how do you get around that?
I mean, you have to change the laws to change the incentives that drive the behavior of the utilities.
Sam?
This gets very complicated very quickly, but to try to put this in layman's terms, what the proposals that are floating around, where you see this most is New York State, which is really digging deep into to totally reimagining how they're regulating utilities. Instead of rewarding utilities for building infrastructure or for selling kilowatt hours, you reward them for providing services. So you say, we're going to ensure that you make profits based on, you know, making sure the lights stay on, making sure that people are warm and comfortable, and making sure that, you know, voltage is regulated and the grid is stable. As to what that actually looks like, it's very, very complicated, but it's being hashed out in a number of jurisdictions as we speak.
Well, it's interesting that it's happening in New York. Don't they have an abundance of natural gas right there with all the fracking?
Not quite. They actually have many of the same pipeline problems that we do.
I see. All right. I'm getting New York mixed up with Pennsylvania, I think. Okay. Let's go to Chesterfield, and Jim is on the air. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Morning. How are you doing today?
Fine. Go ahead, Jim.
Good. All right. So I am a real estate agent that works the border between Vermont and New Hampshire. And one of the things that I have to counsel my clients with when they're trying to decide between making a purchase of a home in Vermont or versus New Hampshire, they have to take into account the taxes and all the other stuff. But one of the things that I also counsel with is the price of the electricity in New Hampshire. I moved over from Vermont to New Hampshire several years ago and had not experienced the fact that my my electrical bill jumped by 40%.
So even at the residential level, New Hampshire level, pays a lot more.
Yeah. And then the second point I have is that I don't know if anybody's aware, or if you mentioned it when I was out of the car earlier, but there is a natural gas generation plant developer currently looking at a location in Vernon, Vermont, right next door to the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant.
That is being decommissioned right now. Sure. Jim, thank you for calling in. Sam, you were nodding. Go ahead.
So 2 points there. I'd be curious to know when Jim moved over, because historically, maybe someone will call in to correct me on this, but I believe historically Vermont has actually had slightly higher electricity rates than New Hampshire. So maybe he was moving to a home that used more, or maybe he moved just in that period, not this winter, but the past winter, when electricity rates for the winter period went way, way up, but only for sort of a six-month period. So I'd be curious to know that. Also, just his point on the on the Vernon plant. Vermont Yankee went offline. There's a lot of electricity infrastructure there, so that's a very attractive site to developers. They've talked about a biomass plant there, and indeed a natural gas plant is eyeing the site as well.
All right, let's take another call. This is Chris in Stratford. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Well, hi, folks. I've been listening in for a little bit of this, and one of the things that really struck me, I'm a recent solar investor. So I put up a capital investment. I maintain and I insure my solar array and feed it back into the grid. And some of those stranded costs, I absorb. So the net metering helps me to deal with that. But the real shocking item to me was that in the last 15 years, according to ISO, we've only had a 1% increase in New England on renewables. And that strikes me as abysmal. And some of the, there's no silver bullet here, because there's hidden, you brought up fracking and some of the other issues with natural gas, and they're still contributing to the greenhouse problem, and we have a global warming, it's quite evident. Why we don't have a huge push for renewables is just beyond me.
Well, Chris, thanks for calling in. And Clay, that one is for you, I think. What has been the increase in renewables, with all the talk, at least in recent years, about solar and wind and so forth?
Well, you've addressed it earlier with the wind project, and thank you, Jim. I need an acronym. NOPE. People in New Hampshire resist wind, and we can't seem to find a place to site it, even though we have the resource. Now we're starting to talk about offshore wind, which is a possibility. The technology is just now coming out of good R&D stage, but the amount of power out there is phenomenal. We could power the entire
wind
power offshore. Yeah, even the small triangle and within our jurisdiction, there's enough power out there to power the state. It's a long ways away, and we got to build a transmission line to bring it in. But the issue with the thing I want to build on is his my earlier comment about the regulations being antiquated. You know, capping the amount of solar that we can net meter at 50 megawatts is, you know, became an issue in 1 year because of the exponential growth. So while since 1993 growth has been small, now we're seeing a real peak, and we didn't have the regulations in place to absorb that peak. So we had to have emergency legislation. Everybody freaked out, and, you know, now we're trying to get it to the PUC so that we can come up with this rate structure that everybody can kind of calm down about, and we can really deploy to our technical capacity, and then once we get that, we increase the technical capability of the grid to absorb it, and then we move beyond. Mm-hmm. You look in Massachusetts, and we're seeing 800 megawatts. Their goal is 1,600 megawatts. Our goal was 50. I mean, what more do I need to say?
Well, and last question for you, Clay, and for you, Jim, and I apologize, you're going to have to keep it short. Clay, if you could break through one aspect of this energy price logjam that we're talking about, what would it be?
Restructure utilities, exactly like David said. I think it was brilliantly said, and that's the logjam.
The incentives and so forth.
Yep.
How about you, Jim? If you could break through on this price problem in one way.
I think we need elected and appointed state leaders and leaders throughout the region to make the tough decisions to allow for some of these infrastructure projects that will bring expanded natural gas capacity into the region and expanded transmission of other kinds of energy into the region and development. Again, we need all of the above solution, but some of these infrastructure projects will take us a large step toward solving this electrical energy crisis. And
to break costs. Through the NOPE.
Yep.
As you said earlier. Dave, what are you going to be looking at in the next couple weeks or months on this front, the next big decisions or actions? What are you going to be tracking?
Well, I'm very anxious to see if since Hydro-Quebec appears so anxious to pump another 1,000 megawatts of electricity into New England, whether they'll sign up for traffic on a power line in Vermont that's already approved and ready to go.
All right. Dave Solomon, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Dave Solomon, he's a reporter for the Union Leader, New Hampshire Sunday News. His energy column is called Power Plays. Jim Roach, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Jim Roach, president of the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire. Clay Mitchell, good to see you.
Thank you, Laura.
Clay Mitchell, founding member and advisor to the New Hampshire Clean Tech Council and a lecturer at UNH. And Sam Evans-Brown, thanks as always.
Glad to be here.
Sam Evans-Brown, environment reporter for us here at NHPR. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.